Hey folks, happy new year and welcome to another episode of All About the Gear. We're recording this in 2014, though by the time we release it, hopefully the Earth will have completed its pass around the sun and we will be in 2015. So welcome to 2015. Congratulations. I'm glad you made it. This has been a big year for both This Week in Photo and All About the Gear. Doug Kay has been at this crazy clip of reviewing all these amazing cameras, trying to keep up with the releases from the camera companies, and been doing a great job at it. Doug thought it would be a good idea to do this wrap-up show, sort of talk about some of the greatest hits and misses of 2014 in terms of cameras and gear, and then maybe look forward a little bit into 2015 and do some projections as to what we think might happen or might be released. Fingers crossed for certain camera manufacturers. So Doug Kay, man, happy new year, man. We should have had those little noisemakers and hats on for this show.
That's exactly what I thought of when you were saying that. I said, why can't I sit here and make a squeaky sound? And look, for those who are watching the video, I've got my All About the Gear sweatshirt on.
Look at that. All About the Gear. Look at that. See?
Yeah. Woo!
You're like Iron Man. I love it.
Anyway, get those in the This Week in Photo store. They're great. Yeah. The sweatshirt's really nice quality, by the way.
Yeah, cool. Good. I'm glad you like it.
We're going to keeping with the theme of the best camera you can own is the one that comes out right after you buy one. We're going to look at, you know, as you said, what came out last year, where the various manufacturers are going, and what you might look forward to 2014 in 2015. Should you buy now? Should you hold off? We'll try and answer some of those questions.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into it, right? Because one of our New Year's resolutions is to, you know, continually improve the show by tightening it up and making it more concise. So with that in mind, let's dive in, right? So 2014, right? So, you know, it's 2014, like I was saying in the intro, has been a crazy year. There's been lots of moving into, you know, mirrorless cameras coming out and 4K becoming prevalent even on some tiny cameras. Let's just talk about from a high level really quickly, you know, 2014, when you look back, Doug, what do you see in your head as like, okay, that was amazing and I didn't see that coming?
I don't know that there's anything that we didn't see coming, but I think you nailed it on what the trends are that we'll look back towards, and that is the sort of steady movement from DSLRs to mirrorless cameras, although there's been a shift of what that means. We'll talk about that. And the evolution to 4K video, which is being led pretty much by Panasonic and Sony. And those, I think, are the two trends that we'll recognize in 2014, at least trends that are not really vendor-specific.
Yeah. Now, let's just dive into it. So you said that movement to mirrorless, and, you know, we spark controversy on the show all the time when we talk about that. We get flack from people that are shooting DSLR saying that we're bashing DSLRs, et cetera, which we're not. And I said and I maintain that it's the right tool for the right job for the right person. All of this stuff is subjective. You can't say your car sucks because it doesn't climb mountain back roads when you're only using it for commuting, right? So it's the right tool for the right job, and there's no one right answer. But that said, like you said, there has been this definite shift into mirrorless cameras, especially on the advanced amateur side of things. So what do you see, Doug? Does that jibe with what you're seeing?
Well, yeah, in the last couple of years, you know, we've talked about mirrorless cameras. And as you know, people have either, you know, they've been drinking the Kool-Aid or they haven't. But we've been talking about them as being smaller and lighter and more nimble, and that was really the feature. But when it came to other things like ruggedness, weatherproofing, autofocus speeds, things like that, the people who are fans of what we've been calling mirrorless cameras tended to just sort of gloss over the weaknesses of them. But what we're seeing now is a transition to just the concept of, forget whether it's large or small, heavy or light, why do you need a mirror? And, you know, what can you do better in a mirrorless camera than you can in one that has a mirror flopping up and down? And right. I think that's where we're going, because we're getting rid of all of those weaknesses of what we've been calling mirrorless cameras in small cameras. We're actually seeing the evolution in some ways to larger mirrorless cameras coming up. So we'll get into that as we go through them. But I think it's coming down to the fact is that you can make a better camera without a mirror now than you can with a mirror. That's where we're going.
But why? Let's just quickly on that. Why is that? I mean, is it? I know why it is because I shoot mirrorless. But just for the folks that aren't as familiar with mirrorless technology and what it means to remove that mirror from the mix, what does taking that mirror out of the box give you that having one in there doesn't allow you to do?
It really comes down to the power of the processing in the camera, the little computers powered by our little wimpy batteries in there. And if you think about it, if you have a DSLR and you're looking through the optical viewfinder, the light that's coming through the lens is going into your eye so you can see, and a little bit of it is going to the autofocus sensor. None of that light is going to a place where the processor, the computer in the camera, can get to it. And therefore, you can autofocus, but you can't do things like face recognition. You can't do object tracking, which is one of the greatest things that we've seen now in autofocus. Whereas if you get rid of that mirror and you let the light go directly onto the image sensor before you push the button, now the processor has access to everything in that image. It can analyze the image, it can find faces, it can track objects, it can do all sorts of things that it can't do when there's a mirror in the way. And that's the fundamental difference. We got distracted for the last 2 years about, oh, it means we can make smaller cameras. It's actually a matter of all the amazing things we can do by getting the mirror out of the way.
Love it. Great way to surmise that. But on the other side of it, you know, fair and balanced here, is the on the DSLR side, there's still space for DSLRs, you know. And even me saying still is kind of, you know, kind of unbalancing things. So, but in other words, there are uses for DSLRs and there are uses for mirrorless cameras, right? So on the DSLR side, why would someone feel comfortable sticking with the DSLR gear that they already have or even consider going to purchase a new Nikon D810 or, you know, Canon DSLR camera?
Well, as of today, the majority of the high-end DSLRs still have better autofocus technology than most of the mirrorless cameras. So if you're shooting nature, you know, moving animals, if you're shooting sports, and you need really fast autofocus that happens, you know, in between every frame, maybe 12 frames a second, 11 frames a second, the high-end DSLRs are still, as of today, the winners in that category. Also, the manufacturers are making these cameras more rugged, more waterproof.
Sure.
And if you look at Nikon and Canon, they have the huge legacy of lenses, of course, which is critical.
Yeah.
But these advantages of the DSLR technology are disappearing, and that's the evolution that we're going to see.
Yeah, I love that. And I want to, maybe we'll put a link to this in the show notes, but our friends over at The Camera Store TV have a shootout, DSLRs versus several mirrorless cameras, including yours, the Sony A7, the GH4s in there, and I think they have a Fuji in there, several cameras that they went out to a dirt bike track and tested aspects of autofocus from each of these cameras and then came out with winners on both sides. So, you know, I'm not going to give it away. Go watch their review. It's really, really eye-opening as to some of the things that they threw at the camera in terms of being able to focus on things like focus tracking and or lock focus or whatever, and how the different bodies, mirrorless and mirrored, performed in both situations. So I think you'll enjoy that.
Yep.
All right. So the other thing, Doug, was a standout this year for me at least, was 4K. Now, I've been hearing about 4K for, you know, years, obviously, but in my head as a consumer, I was thinking, you know what, my TV's great. I just got it a couple years ago. It's a smart TV. Plus, my eyes are going anyway. I don't need all the resolution. It's totally fine what I have right now. Now we've got these 4K cameras that keep showing up and the 4K TVs and services like YouTube that are now starting to support 4K. What are Doug K's thoughts on 4K? Is it the no-brainer? In other words, when you're shopping for a new camera, should you poo-poo it if it doesn't have 4K, or is it not quite there yet?
Yeah, you know, it's like any evolution of the technology. As the, you know, the switch, think back to the switch to HD television, or if you're have enough white hair, think back to, you know, the beginning of color television, right?
Yeah.
You know, or as I was saying to my son the other day, think back to the beginning of television, because I can remember before television. That's how old
wow.
I am. But it's, you know, we're at the cusp here. We're at the point where it's a chicken and the egg question, and the consumer's just about to dive into 4K TVs. As you say, they're starting to become available. People are starting to buy them. Prices are coming down. And as I've said in previous shows, I think this is probably being led by the wedding photographers, because wedding photographers are out there always having to compete with one another. You know, and if you're planning a wedding, it's an easy thing to have a checklist and check the box that says, oh, yeah, should have 4K video. And so it's going to come probably from that group, and I think that's going to move this forward. We have, you know, a couple of manufacturers who are really leading the way here, and I do think it's going to be it's been a trend for this past year. I think it's only going to continue next year.
So you know, I don't know where 4K is going, but I can tell you it is becoming more and more a part of what I consider essential in my multimediographer tool belt. But that said, so. Let's talk about, you know, we get dinged for this as well. This is going to be a shooting gallery for Doug and Frederick here. So.
Yeah, we're in trouble now.
Yeah, we get dinged for slamming Nikon and Canon. And I want to go on record here at the end of the year saying we are not slamming Nikon and Canon. I've been a Nikon fan since the beginning of time. I still own Nikon cameras and lots of Nikon glass. I was a Nikon shooter forever. Where the dinging from my standpoint, we hear what Doug has to say, but the dinging from my standpoint comes to both of these guys, Nikon and Canon, for what I perceive as a lack of innovation in the area when folks like Sony are, you know, they've been around for a long time and are still innovating. They've got the football and they keep running touchdowns, and, you know, Nikon and Canon don't seem to be doing much. You know, you've got Panasonic, you've got Fuji, all these guys that are keeping the photography space exciting and innovating different ways to capture light and making it more fun. And these guys seem to be like, you know, okay, I'm going to add another knob here. I'm going to do this or whatever. So maybe that'll change in 2015. Fingers crossed that that will change in 2015. But if all indicators, you know, point to what they did in 2014, the forecast is cloudy. Doug Kay, what do you think? Nikon, Canon, what's up with that?
Yeah, what's up with that? I'm with you. I think you're exactly right. I think Canon in particular was disappointing this year. There was not much out. I mean, I think the 5D, did 5D Mark III come out this year or the year before? I can't remember. But it was a good update to the 5D. Mm-hmm. No doubt about it. Good, solid DSLR. A lot of new features in that Mark III. The D70 is probably the camera that excited me the most from Canon. It's a small APS-C center, smaller. A great new technology in there for autofocusing called dual pixel. And then they came out with the 7D, which is sort of their higher-end camera. Mm-hmm. Again, we're about to publish our review of that camera. I've got the flak jacket on. People are going to beat up on me for this. I was not impressed with the image quality of that camera, as we'll see in that review about to be published. But not, as you said, not much innovation. Nikon, again, some hits and misses. Oh, let me put on my second flak jacket. The Nikon DF, to me, was a miss. It was them experimenting with retro. A great camera internally, there's no doubt about it, but a funky camera to use. But, you know, people out there who have them love them and are already slinging their arrows.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I got to chime in on that, Doug, because I've got some of the arrows or, you know, whatever. I took some flack for dinging the DF as well. And the thing, if I recall correctly, the thing that got me about the DF was, you know, yeah, I see what they were trying to do with the retro look and the two-tone and all that stuff, which is cool. But it was the higher price for what you get and the omission of certain features, like, say, just being able to record video, you know, on the camera, that kind of, it, you know, I understand, you know, I could almost sit in that, be a fly on the wall in a conference room when they were sort of sketching this thing out, and the ethos that they had in mind of, we're going to bring things back to f-stops and shutter speeds again, you know, but unfortunately, we don't live in an f-stop and shutter speed world. That's like saying, hey, we're going to, you know, let's be nostalgic and bring back the horse and buggy. But, you know, those don't work so well on today's highways. So, you know, I kind of felt like it was a miss in that respect. So, and I guess you agree as well.
I do. And, you know, I'm glad your experiences were similar to mine and that you didn't have to just defend my opinion on that. Yeah. But, you know, Nikon did a couple of good things. They had problems with the D800 and D800E 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and they replaced that with the DA10, which to me is an excellent camera and a much more general purpose camera. Not only did they solve the problems, the technical flaws in those earlier cameras, but they made a camera which, because the autofocus is better, is now a good general purpose camera as long as you can deal with the huge images that come out of it.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, Doug, you bought the Nikon D800 and the D800E back then, didn't you?
Just the E. I owned an E. It's long gone. It's long gone, but it was. I loved it while I had it. It was great. But I replaced it with a much less expensive Sony with a sensor that's just as large.
Yeah.
And then, you know, late in the year here, we've had the D750. Again, I was disappointed because we talked about the fact that we love the D700 from years past. We figured adding 50 to 700 ought to come out with a better camera, but in many ways they brought the camera down market, made it more of an enthusiast camera, less of a pro camera, and to me that was a disappointment. So Nikon, Canon, both of you guys, you know, how long can you just rest on your lenses, so to speak?
I like that. Yeah, Nikon and Canon, it's time to take that lens cap off. Really? Stop just sitting there gathering dust. But, you know, I have faith, man. I have faith in Nikon and Canon. You know, I did a show with, just yesterday we recorded a show, the last TWIP of 2014, with Brian Matias and Nicolzi. And Nicole shoots, you know, it's funny, I did not lead the witness at all, but it was funny, I was talking to Nicole at one point, and she was talking about what she shoots, and how she shoots Canon and all that, and, you know, she's living in a household with Brian, they're married, obviously, and Brian is a big Sony shooter, so he shoots A7, I think he's one of the artisans on the Sony artisan team, so Nicole's like, she's doing the apologetics, you know, which I hadn't heard before, it's like, you know what, I still shoot Canon, but I'm investigating, you know. instead of defending, it was apologetic. So, and I didn't say anything. I was like, wow, that's an interesting twist.
Yeah.
All right.
She'll get there.
yeah. We'll see. But hey, maybe she doesn't need to get there. Maybe, you know, maybe at CES at the beginning of the year or Imaging USA or something, these guys will blow our doors off and say, this, we are setting the standard for mirrorless technology. We've removed the mirror. All your lenses will work on these new series of cameras that we've built, and have at it, and just blow the doors off with 4K and everything that people want that these other manufacturers have left on the table. This is a chance for, I think, Canon and Nikon to use Sony, Olympus, Panasonic as their R&D departments and build the best of the best based on what everyone's asking for, put that out that still works with all their old lenses, and now the tune will change. Like, you will be like, oh, well, maybe I should go look at Nikon again.
Well, you know, maybe we should just go there right now and say, what do we think those guys are going to do next year?
Let's do that. Yeah, I mean, we had that push to the end of the show. Let's do it now.
Yeah, let's. We're right there. So let's talk about that. Where are these guys going to go? Mm-hmm. First of all, I wouldn't hold my breath for the kind of innovation that you're talking about from these two large DSLR manufacturers. My sense is that both of them are going to continue to protect their lens markets, pretty much. Mm-hmm. What I do think both of them are going to do is probably come out with larger sensors. And I don't mean physically larger in medium format. I mean denser in terms of more megapixels. We're back to the megapixel wars, but only with the full-frame cameras. Mm-hmm. I'm expecting to see sensors on the order of 50, 55 megapixels from both Canon and Nikon next year.
Jeez.
And part of it is because they can. Mm-hmm. Part of this has to do with the problems of the technical limitations of these things, and that's diffraction. If you look at these cameras, you know, a Micro Four Thirds camera is, almost all of them are 16 megapixels.
Yeah.
And the the size of those pixels, if you extend that to an APS-C or a mid-size sensor, you're going to have about 25 megapixels. So the limit for an APS-C camera is around 25 megapixels. Denser than that, and you're going to have too much diffraction. Well, when you scale that up to a full frame, you can actually go not to 36, which is where we are today, but you can go all the way up to 55 or 60 megapixels and still have the same density on the sensor that you have in a Micro Four Thirds. And that's where I think Canon and Nikon are going to go, because their glass is still going to work, their bodies are still going to be basically the same, but they'll take over this medium format market without having to gut their product line.
Yeah, I hear you, but as you were talking, I was thinking, those are going to be some gargantuan file sizes, and you know, who needs that? Who needs all that data? You know, which photographers? I know landscape photographers would be dancing on the ceiling for that. Food photographers, in studio, commercial photographers would love that, like you said, to replace the medium format cameras. But for the rest, for the base of the pyramid, you know, I'm like, who needs that much data with every shutter click? And then there's write speeds for the cards, and you know, space on the hard drive, and you know, Photoshop trying to crunch all that data. It just seems like a lot of data. It seems like you're driving a semi-trailer to go pick up a loaf of bread or something.
I mean, it's true, but that's the market that they're going after. That's where it's heading, and that's sort of what they've got left, is that high-end pro market. I mean, they've got that all to themselves. There's nobody really competing with them there. Mm-hmm. So they'd be stupid not to go after it. But you're right. The average shooter isn't going to start going for 50 megapixel files.
Yeah. All right, let's move on from these guys for a second. Or did you have anything else to say about Nikon and Canon?
No, I mean, I think that's where they're going. Canon's going to stick probably with the same type of body. I hope that they start using their dual pixel technology in other places. If Canon does come out with a mirrorless camera, this dual pixel technology for autofocus is a killer technology. And they're actually probably better poised using their own technology for autofocus in mirrorless cameras than Nikon is. Nikon would probably have to get their technology from Sony, which they do quite often. But Canon has a real nice mirrorless technology that they could deploy. Let's see where that goes.
Yeah, fingers crossed for both of those guys, you know, not only for the companies, because I don't want to see them Kodak'd, but also for the millions of people out there and the gazillions of lenses that might be orphaned if they, you know, continue to do what they're doing or not do anything.
Yeah, the other thing about Canon, though, you know, when the 5D was starting to be used for video and DSLR video became a pretty big thing, Canon sort of owned that space. But Panasonic, who has a long heritage of video in their company, has come up so fast, especially with the 4K stuff now, that Canon is in running the risk of losing their video business. I should say there's still camera, still frame, still camera video business, if there is such a market, to Panasonic. Canon is going to have to accelerate that, otherwise Panasonic is going to take over the market for people who want video in their cameras.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move on to the next big name of 2014, and that's Fuji. Fuji seems to have like almost an Apple-like fan base of users. You know, Valerie Jardin, who's a host of our Street Focus show, is, you know, if you cut her, she'll bleed Fuji colors, I think. And she's not sponsored by them. She gets no compensation from these guys. But she just loves the cameras. I know Zach Arias is another person that just loves Fuji. I've seen David Hobby carrying around an X100S. You know, it's like Fuji is almost, in a lot of ways in my head, like the new Leica or something, or the everyman Leica. I don't know. What do you think, Doug?
You know, as you were saying leading up to that, it's exactly what I was thinking. Fuji is great in two areas. One is they make cameras that you can actually get relatively passionate about. They're really nice to use. The controls are well thought out. They probably have the best controls of any of these, any small cameras out there.
Yep.
The other thing is the company has got such a great attitude. No other company comes close when it comes to not only firmware updates, but actually improving their cameras over the life cycle during which you own them. So if you bought an X100S, you've already been through a couple of firmware updates. The X-T1 had a recent major firmware update. So, you know, we got used to this in the smartphone market where you buy a phone and, wow, iOS or Android are updated and you get new features. Your investment actually gets better and better. You get apps. The apps improve the value of your phone. Fuji is the one company that is really listening to users and updating their existing products while you own them, which is really cool. And that's part of the reason that everybody loves them.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And that, like, to go back to the beginning of the conversation, that is a side effect or a benefit of mirrorless, right? Because, you know, I know they had, like, the Magic Lantern hacking and firmware updates for DSLRs that gave you things like, you know, different shutter speeds and different capabilities. But when they update these mirrorless cameras, it's because the cameras are mostly software driven, right? It's like you're saying, it's data hitting that sensor, and then the computer is doing stuff with it. They can actually add features to the camera not over the air, but they can issue a firmware update that now, boom, suddenly you have focus peaking and you didn't even know it, you know, without buying brand new hardware.
And that's an example of that is when Sony first came out with their NEX cameras, people were complaining that the video button was too easy to hit. So they came out with a thing that says, fine, we'll make it so that the video button doesn't do anything if that's what you'd prefer. I mean, they're all the cameras, as you say, are soft, and they can change all these things. But Fuji is just terrific about that. And if you're looking to buy a new camera and you haven't ever used any of the Fuji cameras, go out and rent one and try it, because if you're a serious photographer, I think you'll really like the way the controls work on these things. They're very well thought out.
All right. Well, let's continue our flow of breaking our rundown here and talk about Fuji for 2015. So what do you see coming for these guys? Aside from these new cameras, like you mentioned, the X-T1, the X100, S-NT, and the X30, not a whole lot of new stuff out of them this year. What about next year?
Well, you know, I follow all the rumor sites out there and try to get a sense of it. Fuji has gone on the record saying that they're not going to go into full frame for the time being. They're going to stay at APS-C size, mm-hmm. or mid-size sensors. Mm-hmm. The only thing I've been able to glean about where Fuji is going is sort of more of the same.
All right, let's move down. Panasonic and Lumix. You know, I shoot with Panasonic stuff. So what do you think? So we've got, over the year, I've got my GH4 up there. And, you know, a couple of other cameras that I really, really enjoy. I'm anxious to hear what you think about what Panasonic did this year.
Panasonic's had a great year. They've got, of course, the GH4 came out with 4K video. Panasonic is really the leader in 4K video. They're the only ones who can record 4K video direct to an SD card. Sony has 4K video on one of their cameras, but you need an external recorder. GH4, I expect, will be upgraded next year to something new. The LX100, I think you have one of those there, don't you?
Yes, I have one right here. Look at this. In my hot little hands, the LX100.
I love that.
This little thing.
Yeah, I love that too. That's a camera that I think is going to be very popular, already is very popular. And then the little GM5. I've got this little teeny one here. I've got a little red one that I'm reviewing right now, and I like it quite a bit. Even the FZ1000, which is a crossover camera, a big camera with a huge zoom range. Great stuff. So, in terms of 2015, all I know is that I'm expecting Panasonic to continue their push with video, because that is currently their differentiator. If you look at the markets they have to go into, you know, they and Olympus share the Micro Four Thirds market. So their differentiator from Olympus is clearly video, and also their relationship with Leica for lenses. And then as you move up to compete with Fuji, Sony, and the big bodies, I still think video is the thing that Panasonic gets the best. Maybe also user interfaces. They have very nice menus and touch screens and things like that. But video is still going to be the kingpin for Panasonic Lumix.
Well, let me ask you this on the Panasonic side, and this extends to Olympus as well, with regard to sensor size and Micro Four Thirds and that 16.3 megapixel sensor. Are we going to see over the next couple of years or at any point Panasonic and or Olympus going up to, say, an APS-C sensor size?
I mean, it's a whole new product line. They've sort of bet the farm on the idea of this interchangeable standard, Micro Four Thirds. There's nothing to keep them from doing it. Both companies have a lot of experience making lots of optical products, but It's hard. They've been reasonably successful at this Micro Four Thirds. It's hard to imagine them deciding to sort of split their market and go that way.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so then forward-looking, I have my own opinions. I want to hear yours on the Panasonic side, the Lumix side. Looking forward into 2015, first of all, the standouts, you know, I have my own opinion is in regards to standouts is a GH4, like you said, with the 4K video, and it was kind of my first, quote, serious, I guess the GH3 was my first serious mirrorless camera. The GH4 is the first, you know, state-of-the-art mirrorless camera with focus peaking and 4K video and, you know, all this other crazy stuff that it does. So that would be my standout on the mirrorless side. And then secondly, my other standout would be, like I said before, this guy, this LX100, which if you look at the reviews, there's, you know, we've got a review on All About the Gear. If you just search for LX100 on thisweekinphoto.com, there's another really good review on the Camera Store TV. They've got a good review on the LX100 and a couple of other ones. And the main thing that I took away from those reviews about this little camera is it is deceptively powerful for how small it is. And it is essentially, for you GH4 shooters out there, it's essentially a GH4 in this little tiny compact body because it shoots 4K. It has the GX7 sensor in it. And the processing engine in this guy, though the sensor is from the GX7 series, the processing engine is from the GH4, which gives you focus peaking and, you know, all those powers that you have in a larger, more professional, interchangeable lens camera are in this thing, but it shoots 4K as well. So for me, it's making, you know, I call it a standout because I'm shooting the GH4, and now when I do interviews in the field or shoot or I need a backup camera or I don't want to take multiple cameras, this goes with me in my bag, and I feel like I can always get GH4 level quality. So that's my other standout. All right, Doug, let's move on, man. Let's get off of Panasonic and move on to Olympus. So yeah, They're the other player in the Micro Four Thirds space that, you know, frankly, Olympus was my gateway drug into Micro Four Thirds with my OMD EM5, which I still have and love. But over 2014, what have we seen from them? I don't recall seeing too much other than, you know, one or two bodies.
Yeah, I had to go back through my notes because, of course, I can't remember what came out on in which month.
Yeah.
There was surprisingly little. And I also went back to all of the reviews we've published so far, over 30 reviews on All About the Gear. The highest rated camera, if you use our numerical rating system, is still the Olympus OMD EM1. Mm-hmm. It is a marvelous camera, but that came out in 2013, I believe. So it's more than a year old. Wow. In the OMD line, the only thing I could really think of was the EM10, which is almost a year old, and that's a really nice entry-level Micro Four Thirds camera. I'm not sure that it offers as much as the competing Lumix camera does, but that's where they went. They've done a lot, of course, with the Pen line. They've done a few cameras there. Low-end, we've not reviewed any of the Pen cameras, and we should probably try and do that next year.
Yeah, I agree.
But my sense is that Olympus is suffering from their business problems, and we should mention this here. You know, 3 years ago, they had quite a scandal over at Olympus. 7 executives were arrested. 3 of them pled guilty to cooking the books for Olympus, and, you know, they made a mess of the company. They lost 2,700 jobs. They had to shut down 40% of their factories. They had to take an investment by Sony and Mitsubishi, who owns Nikon. So 17% of the company is owned by competitors, essentially, now. And there is a bit of a relationship with Sony.
Yeah. I wonder how that, I mean, you know, again, armchair quarterback, but I wonder how that kind of relationship impacts their R&D department and the release of new cameras that compete with, you know, the folks that saved their butt when they were in trouble, you know? Yeah. In other words, would you say, you know what, let's make this camera not so good because it's competing with some of the offerings from Sony and those are our friends over there, so let's not make it as good as we could. You think there's any of that going on?
It's interesting because, you know, one of the standout features of the OMD cameras is the image stabilization in the body.
Yeah.
You have a sensor that can, you know, vibrate in order to compensate for motion.
5-axis, yeah.
And now we see that technology in the Sony cameras. So Sony denies that they've used Olympus's technology, but I wonder how true that is, because that was sort of a breakthrough here at the very end of 2014 to see that come into the Sony line. So, you know, there's technology moving both ways, but I'm a little nervous about Olympus from a business perspective and a long term, because I don't know that the company can afford to stay in this business.
Yeah. You think it's time for a merger between Olympus and, say, Panasonic to make a real contender against Sony and the other guys?
I don't think that's going to happen, because if you look at the corporate structure, remember, the camera business is pretty small for both of these companies. Panasonic and Olympus are both, you know, large corporations doing lots of different things.
Right.
Making cameras for people is not their is not the primary business for either one of them.
Yeah, it's not the thing that keeps the lights on, right?
No.
Yeah. All right. So Olympus. So I guess looking forward, the future does not look that bright, but it's still not completely dark.
I should say Olympus has one technology that they've patented. They got a couple of things, and we should not throw them out with the bathwater here.
Okay.
First of all, they have a sensor shift technology where they take multiple images. You know, the normal sensor, for every pixel, there are actually four subpixels, if you will, in a little array. There's a red, two greens, and a blue. And that's in a little square. And each pixel, therefore, has some red, green, and blue in it, but they're from slightly different locations. So they have to be combined, and that hurts the resolution. But what they do in sensor shift, which is invented, I think, by Hasselblad, is they take a picture, they move the sensor a little bit, they take another picture, they move the sensor again, and they move it again. They take 4 or 8 or 16 separate images so that they get a red pixel, a green pixel or two, a blue pixel at each location. And then they combine them and they get these really high resolution images. You know, Hasselblad has a 200 megapixel camera that uses this technology. Olympus has a 40 megapixel, or a version that could do 40 megapixels. So we might see, they've already talked about an EM5 Mark II that's been registered, that trademark is out there. The EM5 Mark II could be a 40 megapixel camera announced in the first quarter of next year using this sensor shift technology. That would be sort of cool. Would give them a leg up.
And that's a way to extend the life of that Micro Four Thirds sensor size too, right?
That's right. That's right. Because they're actually shooting 40 megapixels, if you will, but the problem is that some of them are red pixels and some of them are green and some of them are blue. Well, it'd be nice to get all three colors in all of the pixels.
Interesting.
And they can do that. I mean, Hasselblad does that with a big sensor. Olympus doing it with a small sensor, it's easier for them in a small camera because the mass of the sensor is less, so they can move that thing around.
Yeah.
Olympus has another thing which is really interesting. They've got something called OPC, the Open Platform Camera, and they've sort of open sourced their technology. This isn't talked about much here in the States. It's a Japanese only project. The documentation's only in Japanese. You have to pretty much be in Japan to get it. But this could be, you know, when you're going down with the ship, you know, you start throwing things out for free. But this, you know, just like you talked about Magic Lantern, which is an open source project involved with Canon cameras, they could be having a company sponsored open source thing here with the OPC. We'll see where that goes.
So, Doug, bottom line here, because I'm getting nervous, you know, talking to you about Olympus. So, folks, you know, there are folks that own Olympus, like I do. I own Olympus camera and lens right now, so I am an Olympus customer, and I'm a Panasonic customer. So I'm thinking, you know, on the Micro Four Thirds side of things, it seems to be Olympus and Panasonic, right? So it's a consortium between Olympus, Panasonic, and Leica that make these Micro Four Thirds, this kit, you know, this gear. If Olympus folds for some reason, that leaves one, Panasonic. I mean, is that a bad thing or is that a good thing?
It's no worse than we have with any other camera platform. This, remember, Micro Four Thirds is the only one that has a consortium. So,
that's right.
You know, you're just back to the same battleground you are with any of the other camera manufacturers. You're no worse off. So, you know, your camera will continue to work, and your lenses, if you want a new body, you can always buy a Panasonic body. So I don't think anybody needs to be worried about it, but, you know, part of the beauty of that Micro Four Thirds standard is having two vendors in it. So let's hope they keep going.
All right, let's move on. Let's move on to Sony, right? Like I said at the beginning of the show, one of the heroes of 2014 and 2013, frankly, with all of their innovations around these full frame mirrorless cameras, and even before that with the Alpha series of DSLRs that they make are just, you know, I was talking about those before I even started talking about mirrorless cameras, because those things are amazing what Sony's doing. I think Sony's biggest Achilles heel with the Alpha series is, and many of the other things that they do, is marketing, and that no one knows about those cameras, you know, because you pick up one of those big DSLR Sony Alphas, and you're like I said on the show before, it's like the Iron Man of cameras. It just does everything that you have wished other cameras would do. It does it. The problem is, no one knows about it. You know, they don't tell anybody. They build these awesome things and keep them in the underground garage, and you know, they use their Field of Dreams marketing, and it doesn't work. So, but that said, moving forward, they released some awesome cameras this year and last year. So, of the standouts, you know, or of all of them, I know you're an owner of some of these. What do you think? What has Sony done this year?
Well, as you said, they have some confusion, because they've combined their product line so that both the mirrorless cameras and the larger ones are all called Alpha. So you have the Alpha 99, the Alpha 77, which are the large-bodied mirror-based cameras, both terrific cameras. And then you have all the Alpha 7 cameras, which are, you'd think, are also Alpha, but those are the mirrorless ones. Then you have the little ones, you know, like the RX models, like this one. It is confusing, but to me, it was a tough call. The standout cameras for me, my camera of the year for 2014 is the Sony A6000. It is just a mind-bogglingly good camera, which is now down to something like $550.
That's insane.
You know, and this camera has some of the best autofocus tracking.
Everything. It's like almost the ideal street photography camera in a lot of ways.
It really is. It really is. It's an APS-C sensor. You can put on an 18-200 zoom that isn't too big. You can put primes on it. But the key is the autofocus in this camera is superb. And image quality is just excellent. And that price point, you know, there are a lot of cameras that are nowhere near as good that cost a whole lot more. So it's really a bargain. And we're going to see an A7000, I think, this year. Early 2015. And I think it would be interesting to see, if they up the game on the autofocus technology, do they add image stabilization to this thing? Where do they go? Because that camera's due for an update. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to go to Paris earlier this year for a workshop with Valerie, and several people on the workshop had those A6000s, and they had just gotten them and brought them to the workshop, and they were just like blown away, like, I can't believe that every shot I took, you know, was in focus and perfect and all this stuff. So the whatever magic pixie dust Sony sprinkled on this thing to make it focus the way it does and track and ensure that your delete to keep ratio is so, you know, is so good, it's, keep doing it, because people seem to love this camera, including you. So you own this camera right now, right, Doug?
I do, and I'm leading a workshop in Cuba in 2 weeks, and that's the primary camera I'm taking with me. Even though I've got bigger, fancier ones, that's the one I plan to shoot with the most.
But you're bringing other cameras.
I am. Well, I'm bringing the new Sony A7 Mark II also to review, but I happen to do a good job. I just coordinated the borrowing that camera from Borrow Lenses to coincide with my Cuba trip. Isn't that convenient?
That is, you know, that sounds like a Doug K right there.
I'll be talking in Cuba. We'll see how.
So talk about that a little bit. You know, the A7S in particular. I know that's one that you own, and I put that as my other camera of the year when we talked about it on this last episode of This Week in Photo. And particularly the A7S, because of the sensor or the low light sensitivity in that thing. It, you know, I don't know, it's bending space and time somehow, or capturing light from multiple dimensions simultaneously, but that thing is insane for the quality of low light performance that you get out of that little tiny package. And you own this thing, right?
I do. I love the A7S. That is actually my primary camera now, except when I'm doing I'm traveling and I'll take the A6000 instead.
Yeah.
Although I may take the A7S to Cuba also, but the A7S shooting, you know, theoretically up to 409,000 ISO. But you know, I use it up to 25,000 ISO all the time. And it's marvelous. And there are only two other cameras that can do that, by the way. The Nikon DF, all we've criticized it for, still does great high ISO, and the Nikon D4S, $6,500, but it also has that same high ISO potential.
Yeah.
But I love the A7S, marvelous camera. I sold my regular A7, and so the A7S I use for most photography. The A7R I use for tripod landscape work, and I'm looking forward to seeing what this Mark II A7 will do, whether it's worth it or not.
Yeah. Have you heard any information on what it's got in it, or is it just
The main thing about the A7 Mark II is in-body image stabilization. That's what we talked about. That's the magic there. I mean, consider this, that Olympus has done this in their Micro Four Thirds cameras.
Mm-hmm.
But they, you know, they do this by moving the sensor around to compensate for motion of the body.
Sure.
If you do this in a full frame camera like Sony, you have a sensor whose mass is more than four times the mass of a Micro Four Thirds sensor. The area alone is four times, and then of course it's going to be thicker as well. So they have to move a lot of stuff around real quickly.
Yeah, I'd be interested. I want to see that review, or I guess I'll be present for it. But one of the things I'm curious about is battery life, because some folks on many of the trips that I went on this year had A7s with them, and their main complaint was battery life. You know, I'm out there shooting all day on one battery, and they've swapped two or three times throughout the day because the thing was sucking battery. And if they haven't improved the battery life with the A7 Mark II, then now you've got it sucking power for the image stabilization as well as everything else. So I'm curious as to see what they did there. Has that been your experience, battery life, with that thing?
Absolutely, but you know, get over it. You know, just carry some extra batteries. They're small. I mean, they're really tiny.
Doug K, the Sony apologist. No, I love it.
It's not just Sony. It's any small cameras. I mean, I have a choice. So here, those watching video, there's a little Sony battery. It's a teeny little thing.
Yeah.
You know, I've got batteries for my big Nikon that are larger than some of my cameras.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, you have a choice. Yeah, you could put a bigger battery in this camera. Do you want to hold that in your hand all day, or would you rather just have a couple of batteries in your pocket and pop them in? I think that's not a big deal, really.
Yeah, no, I agree. But, you know, I'll say that the battery life on my GH4 is, you know, it's scary long, right? It's so long that you're like, is this gauge actually right? Because I've been shooting 4K video and stills since yesterday, and we're midday today, and I still have two bars left, you know? And even then, I'm like you. I still have like two extra batteries fully charged in my bag because that's, you know, the photojournalist in me. But I'm covered there. But I'm like, is this battery still good? What's going on here? And I think that's the way it should be with these. I don't think there should be a compromise. If that camera can do that, the Sony can do at least half that. You know, considering the sensor size and all that. So
it's true.
There's some work to do there.
As long as you got to move these little motors and gyros and move these sensors around, you're going to burn up more battery. So you know, you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
And if you want more stuff, if you want image stabilization, if you want better processing, you're going to need more juice.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. But I still think they could do a little more work on that. So I'm advocating for you, Doug. You got to go to Cuba, you know, and now legally buy your cigars to bring them back, right?
I'm ready.
So, all right. So your camera of the year is A6000. I have to pick a different one. My camera of the year, like I said, is the A7S and the GH4 combination. Like, what's his name? Dave Dugdale at learningdslrvideo.com. has an awesome tutorial up about the G4, and I think he personally has bought an A7S and a GH4 for his video kit, and now he's got kind of that sweet spot. So, you know, I'm excited about both of those cameras for different reasons this year.
Yep.
All right, so let's wrap it up. This is we went almost twice as long as we intended to go for this show.
Well, it's because we're covering 2 whole years.
We are covering 2 years. Yes, we are. So I guess all in all, this has been an exciting year to be a photographer in any capacity, over any genre, lots of choices and all that. So let's put a fine point on it and end the show here. 2015. We've got lots of shows coming up in January. There's CES. We're going to see new stuff there. I know Sony has a giant booth teed up and ready to talk about some cool stuff there. We've got Imaging USA coming. We've got all these shows coming. What is coming up in 2015, Doug? Put on your magic hat and look into the future and tell us what we're going to see.
Yeah, I think we won't see too much at CES. We'll see more in the compact and point-and-shoot market. But Sony and some others have already lined up some major announcements for February. So I think we're going to see a lot there. The trends I think we're going to see are, first of all, 4K video is going to go mainstream. Mm-hmm. By this time next year, 4K televisions in the home are going to become much more common. And that's going to drive the 4K video quite a bit. We might see, might not be for another year, but we're going to start to see 8K video. and, you know, crazy as that is. Of course, no, we won't have devices to display it on. So maybe I'm a little ahead of things here. Definitely going to see, not definitely, nothing's definite. I really do expect to see the megapixel wars reactivated from Nikon and Canon. I expect both of those companies to come out with these really high resolution sensors, and I expect they'll be full frame, not medium format, because medium format means they have to abandon their glass.
Yep.
Another interesting trend to watch out for is, you know, we did a review of the Lytro Illume. Mm-hmm. In fact, has that been published yet? Let me see. No, that hasn't been published yet. That's coming up in a couple of weeks here. Yeah. But I learned that Intel has also done a lot of work with light field technology, and there's some rumors out there that Fuji might get involved with light field technology. So we might see that grow a little bit. But overall, we're going to see innovation continue where it's been from, and that's primarily Sony is still the innovator, way ahead of the rest in that area. Panasonic probably comes in number two with Lumix. Fuji is off on their own track. It's a great track, but it's very uniquely Fuji. Olympus, worried about quite a bit. Nikon and Canon, we've said, big megapixels. Are they going to really dive into mirrorless? Wow, we're just going to have to wait and see.
Yeah. So the space continues to be exciting, and we continue to have fodder for episodes of All About the Gear.
Right. Yeah. I think one last comment on this. I think what we're seeing in the big trend is, and more, we're going to see it more in 2015, and that is it's really all about the processors in these cameras. It's less and less about optics. It's even, you know, mechanics. You still have, in-body image stabilization. Shutters will be an issue. People really like electronic shutters, and all these manufacturers are working hard to make it more practical to have an electronic shutter that makes no sound instead of a mechanical shutter. A lot of reasons that's hard to do. But we'll see more and more silent cameras, but we'll see more and more processing. Processing is how these cameras are going to eke out more and more quality.
Love it. It's going to be exciting. All right, Doug, what's up for, you know, at the end of these shows, I always ask you what's up for the next show or what you have planned, but I want to expand that a little bit. What's up for 2015 for All About the Gear? What's any exciting changes you got planned?
No major change. You know, we made the big change a few months ago with the new website.
Yeah.
That and the release of the audio version of All About the Gear. Very exciting and very popular. But we've got, you know, the Canon 7D Mark II is coming up, the Lytro Illume, the Lumix GM5, that Sony A7 Mark II, the Fujifilm X100T. We've got 5 reviews already lined up for the first part of the year.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to see what comes out in January and February to see where we go from there. It's going to be a very exciting year, but it's, again, going to be based, I think, primarily on improved processing of images.
All right, Doug. Well, that's it.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. That's it for another episode of All About the Gear. Doug Kay, I'll see you in the next one.
Okay, see you. Bye-bye.